FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
Welcome. You are listening to the Financial Survival Network. I'm Carrie Lutz. Today is 2/19/19. Well, if you've been watching the shenanigans going on in New York, we've got our latest and greatest Congresswoman Sandy Ocasio-Cortez, also known as Occasional Cortex. We've got Governor Cuomo. We've got Comrade de Blasio. They're all in a headlong rush to bankrupt New York State. And somebody who's been really at the forefront of trying to breathe fiscal sanity and financial sanity, somebody whose work I have personally been reading for many years. I'm talking about E.J. McMahon. And E.J., you are research director at the Empire Center for Public Policy and an adjunct fellow at the Manhattan Institute, both entities really out there trying to help get fiscal sanity to prevail. Welcome to the show, E.J.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And so New York is really just kind of descending into economic, social, fiscal chaos. And it seems like that nobody wants to admit it and nobody wants to pretty much deal with the situation.
Well, if it makes you feel better, several large states are in worse financial shape than New York, but I don't know if that's something to boast about. But I would say Illinois is no basket of cheer, and New Jersey, nor is New Jersey.
Yeah.
So if that makes you feel better, if you were choosing among the three of them, New York is probably the least worst, and there's a few others that are also troubled. So there's no question that things are not headed in the right direction here, and there's a very big political imbalance in the state capital to a degree we haven't seen in a very long time, not in living memory. So I think that creates a lot of risks. So that this it's potentially a turning point for the worse in a lot of ways.
And I think the nail in the coffin was the new tax law. Look, I lived in New York most of my adult life and paid these ridiculous taxes, although I lived in outside of Manhattan, so at least I didn't get hit with city taxes. And
right.
And now Cuomo actually confessed that the tax law was really bad for New York. He met with Trump last week begging for relief. There's nothing that Trump can do. And basically, it speeded up the already rapid exodus of high-end taxpayers from the state.
Well, it creates a bigger, an even bigger incentive for people who are really high earners to leave the state. It's been misunderstood. The impact has been kind of distorted and misunderstood in part because Cuomo himself has deliberately distorted it to begin with. He painted the new federal tax law as broadly bad for most New Yorkers, when it actually, the net result is that it raises taxes for a small number of very high earners who pay a really huge percentage, considering their numbers, of our income tax revenues. And that's the problem he faces now. So we're referring in both cases to the thing that's called SALT, S-A-L-T, the state and local tax deduction, which previously was almost unlimited. It actually had a little bit of a cap connected with it that was pretty complicated under previous law. Under new law, your ability to claim an itemized deduction for state and local taxes is limited to $10,000. And so obviously that had the biggest effect on a handful of states with high income people and that are dependent on income taxes. So that was New York and California in particular, to a lesser extent, slightly lesser extent, Jersey,
Connecticut, Massachusetts, Maryland.
Massachusetts is actually not a high tax state, and Massachusetts has wealth, but not high taxes. That's something that's misunderstood about Massachusetts. Massachusetts has lower taxes than many deep red states, actually, but that's a whole other issue. But it has wealth, and the wealth is taxed through, is hit by the income tax, and that's no longer deductible. Now, you know, I'm going to say something that's not that most people who have been writing and talking about this from a conservative standpoint don't agree with, although I think they should, which is that the unlimited deduction for state and local tax was actually the most conservative thing about the tax code, to the extent that it basically said you give precedence to your state and local governments. Essentially, they get their hand in your pocket first, and the federal government gets what's left. If you're any sort of conservative, you should actually value local and state government over the federal government. And the tax code is and always has been redistributive. So New York was already generating far more in taxes than it received back in federal funding, which was appropriate. Like, for instance, about residents of Long Island, there's fewer than 2 million residents of Long Island, just Long Island. They generated more individual income tax than everybody who lives in Tennessee, which has a larger population, or for that matter, Wisconsin. It's because the income tax is steeply progressive on the federal level and takes money from higher income people in states and redistributes it to lower income states. Now, that's not a defense of New York's tax code in the city or the state or New York's spending proclivities. But, of course, as you know, as you were saying at the outset, your choice, if you lived in New York and didn't like it, you always had the ultimate choice, which was to leave. And the rest of us here fight against the policies that make the burden really oppressive. Now, Cuomo basically tried to pretend that this whole thing was about the broad middle class when it wasn't. Again, it was about very high income people, particularly millionaire earners, particularly in New York City, where about half our millionaire earners live, who are now going to be paying a higher combined tax rate than they were before the tax law passed. That's the problem he has, because if you accelerate the migration of high-income earners from New York City, and they're not replaced by other high-income earners, then our tax base is going to be eroding faster. And, you know, that's a problem he has, and I don't know what the meeting with Trump was about, because Trump can't do anything about the tax law. He signed it. It's a law. He's not going to change couldn't single-handedly change the SALT deduction, even if he wanted to, and I doubt he actually wants to. So I'm not sure what that was about, other than political theater. But it's stressing the state's finances, and even though the economy is still growing, in part thanks to the added push from the federal tax changes, the state's financial outlook is actually worse than it's been for some time, actually since Cuomo's first year in office. So that's a real challenge for him.
Yeah. And this was all kind of predictable once this bill was passed. So it's not just the wealthy, though, EJ. It's your lawyer making $500,000 a year, which sounds like a huge amount of money, except in New York City, and losing the SALT deduction, losing real estate tax deduction over $10,000. We should say anything over $10,000, no longer deductible.
Right.
Those people, the working wealthy and the working upper middle class, they're the ones who are really taking it on the chin. And look, the thing is that our New York representatives, their senators, could have worked with the Republicans to moderate that. Maybe they could have raised it to $25,000, maybe to $50,000. Certainly, they could have done something, and yet they chose to do nothing. So this is an act of real political negligence, gross negligence, on the part of New York's congressional delegation and its senators.
Well, I won't disagree with that. I mean, several members of our House Republican delegation voted against the bill. Some voted for it, some voted against it. You're right. Our two U.S. senators who are Democrats, Chuck Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, were on the sidelines, in effect. The question is, it's water under the bridge. Whether the Republicans were looking to have any Democratic input on this bill is another question, but you're absolutely right. And Cuomo, who's the person who dominates the bubble that I'm in, was nothing but just throwing really, you know, hot chili pepper partisan bombs at this from the beginning. He was not seeking to lobby or come up with reasonable alternatives. He simply just was just like an unending series of denunciations of congressional Republicans and Trump from start to finish. So he was not positioning himself to try to influence the shape of the bill. He just denounced it. And, you know, as for who is affected by it, keep in mind, one of the things, aspects of the bill that has actually countered or offset the effect for many of the sort of six-figure middle class and more affluent New Yorkers, like the ones you described, is a rollback of the alternative minimum tax, which had a disproportionate impact here in New York. There were a lot of people making between 200 and 800, say, successful business owners, lawyers, as you mentioned, people in the professions, who were actually paying the AMT, which already allowed no SALT deduction. And the combined effect of all the other aspects of the federal tax bill is actually, in most cases, not all, but in most cases, actually producing a small net tax cut for them, despite the loss of SALT. You could be a suburban homeowner in Long Island or Lower Hudson Valley with a state and local tax deduction previously of up, you know, as high as $18,000 or $19,000, depending on your family size and configuration, and still get a tax cut under this bill. The problem from a political standpoint and a budgetary standpoint for the governor is where it most squarely and uniformly increases taxes, and that's on the millionaire earners. Cuomo himself, according to the tax return he released last year, which he does in election years and I think other years besides, his reported income last year was like $210,000 or so, and he lives in Westchester. Mm-hmm. He personally, if you calculated it, is getting a $10,000 tax cut.
Really?
This was in the midst of, based on the income profile he disclosed last year. So this is, it really is a problem. There's no question about it for this state. And at a certain point, the finger pointing has to end, and he has to just deal with it because it's not going to change. It's due to expire. The whole tax law is due to expire at the end of after 2024, including the SALT cap. I don't think anybody expects unlimited state and local tax deductions to really come back into the tax code, though. In fact, something nobody has really called much attention to, other than me, I think, when Chuck Schumer, as Democratic minority leader, and his conference introduced their own big $1 trillion infrastructure bill last year. It had no chance of passing, but it was basically their way. They had their own way of dealing with infrastructure, which is very different from Trump's. Their infrastructure bill is funded largely by income tax increases, including restoration of the alternative minimum tax, which would be a big increase on New Yorkers, Schumer's constituents. And it did not restore the SALT deduction. Repeat, did not. So that gives you an idea of what you're likely to see from future Democratic congressional majorities if they materialize in both houses. By the way, President Obama, for most of his 8 years in office, every year proposed a limitation on all itemized deductions for high-income taxpayers. It wasn't as tight as the SALT cap in this law, but it was pretty tight, and it would have squeezed New York and other high-income states. Mm. So, and that was also Hillary Clinton's campaign tax plan. So this is something that I think is never going to come back and is going to really force... So I think it's going to force a day of reckoning here sooner or later, probably, mm-hmm. unfortunately, later than sooner.
Yeah, well, it's the politicians' way to always put off for tomorrow what they could accomplish today, because then it might be somebody else's problem, right?
Right, yes.
Yep. That's the problem. So, and then we saw Amazon pulling out. My personal opinion is they realized they made a mistake and they just used the whole controversy, people protesting, whatever, to pull out of the deal because they figured out how costly it is and how burdensome it is to run a business in New York City. I did it for 30 years and I couldn't wait to get out. It was the happiest day of my life when I left New York City and no longer had, from parking tickets to excessive parking fees to fines for stuff that you didn't even do. I mean, you name it. New York city is the most hostile place for business on the planet. And I think maybe the reality of that dawned on Jeff Bezos, like, what are we doing here? Why there of all places? So they just called it off.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next.
Egypt is on the verge, once again, becoming a world-renowned gold producer. The Golden Age is being rediscovered. For millennia, ancient Egyptian kingdoms prospered from unparalleled riches. Pharaohs built their empires and flaunted their abundant wealth that was made possible by the country's resource-rich gold deposits. Despite this rich history, modern Egypt remains one of the most underdeveloped gold mining countries in the world. Aton Resources is at the center of the modern Egyptian mining world, diligently working both as the only public exploration company in Egypt today and as the advocate for mining reform with the Egyptian government. However, those that arrive early, like Aton, will reap the best rewards. Aton's discovery of the legendary lost mountain of gold at Rudruin and its current aggressive drilling program there could potentially reap those rewards. Aton Resources is focused on its 100% owned Abu Marwat concession in the Arabian-Nubian Shield, located 200 kilometers north of Sentimen Sakkari's world-class gold mine. Aton possesses first-mover advantage in the underfollowed jurisdiction of Egypt, which is currently undergoing mining reform. To stay on top of Aton's latest drill results and news, go to AtonResources.com. Aton trades on the Toronto Venture Exchange under the ticker AAN and on the OTC under the ticker ANLBF.
The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.
I think there's a lot of truth to what you just said. Somebody will write a book on this eventually, or maybe several, and we'll hear more. But I do think that there was maybe they didn't do much due diligence going in, or as much as they may have thought they had. And then when they really scoped it out, they thought, whoa, well, what are we stepping into here?
Yeah.
They already, by the way, have a significant presence in New York.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So yeah. It's not like, you know, but they did. This was going to be, you know, quote unquote, the second headquarters or half the second headquarters.
Yeah.
I think you're right about that. I think that was a bigger, much bigger factor than anybody's acknowledging so far.
And, you know, they might have a presence there, but, you know, the way corporations work, I'm sure they make no money in New York City directly, or New York State directly attributable, and they pay very little state income tax. They paid no federal income tax on $11 billion in net income last year. So you got to believe they probably pay New York State nothing, but the idea of being semi-headquartered there would probably cost them billions of dollars per year, not to mention all the added operating costs, because New York City, even Queens, is about the highest cost place that you can ever think of doing business in, ever, from rents to just getting lunch for $20 every day. So they'd have to pay those people more money who are moving there, because in Washington State, where they're headquartered, there is no income tax. It's kind of bizarre to think of a company wanting to go from a no income tax state to be co-headquartered in a high income tax state. I never understood the logic behind the move anyway.
Well, there is a trade-off. They get, this is actually, we're probably just at or just past the peak of what's actually been, by historical standards, an economic boom in New York City.
Mm.
There's quite a few companies that find it worth their while to be there because of the concentration of people and talent there and the resources and linkage to the larger financial and global information network, et cetera. However, that trade-off, I think that what also might have panicked them or made them rethink was their realization that, for instance, it's getting harder to get around New York City. You've got a worsening conditions on the subway system, and if you pay more attention to it or pay enough attention to it, you have good reason to lack confidence that the leadership, the political leadership of the state and city, are ever going to get their act together and in any affordable, foreseeable time frame, actually upgrade the subway system, for instance, which is how most people in New York City, especially in Manhattan and that part of Queens, get around. So that, and by comparison, if you look at Northern Virginia, Alexandria and Arlington County, and where in Pentagon City, Crystal City, this region where they are going ahead with their plan, which is an area that already has three metro stops, for instance, they have good reason to believe that, you know, that that Northern Virginia and that region will do a better job of handling the infrastructure challenge and accommodating them in a lower, as you mentioned, a lower cost, generally lower cost, lower tax environment, although it's housing in that area is pretty expensive. They can feel more confident about their outlook in that area than they can in the New York City, in the middle of New York City, which is where they were going to be. So I think, again, I think that's also a consideration, not just a matter of gross tax burden, whatever it would have been. It would have been actually pretty light under the deal they were offered because it had all these incentives in it. But it basically it's getting all those people around and being able to operate in that location. And then on top of it, to have continuing sort of political harassment from these various activists, although they didn't even represent the whole neighborhood. Probably all of that figured in their decision.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. The subways are in a horrid condition. I remember like when it was yesterday, when all of a sudden New York said, oh, we've got to do something about these subways. And all of a sudden you really saw change happening. You really saw, not so much in the stations there, it was filthy and disgusting,
right,
but the trains themselves, all new trains, the tracks,
yes,
everything. And then, you know, 20 some odd years of Democratic rule, considering Bloomberg to be a Democrat too, and chaos in Albany through a number of governors, and we're right back where we started from. Maybe it's even worse because there's more people riding the thing every day.
Well, that's the thing. It's a victim of its own popularity and of the inefficiency and incompetence of its managers, because you're recalling the early 80s, there were tremendous improvements to the transit system in New York. There were tremendous boosts in ridership, and this started in the Koch era, continued through the Giuliani era with its really big dramatic improvement in the drop in crime and sort of vagrancy and all of that. And that's now we're a generation later, and this system that was so crowded is now has falling ridership. Some of the falling ridership are people riding, taking Ubers, and which adds to the worst traffic Manhattan has ever seen ever. Mm-hmm. And so you have the worst of all worlds. You have terrific traffic, massive traffic, in the heart of New York City, and you have worsening conditions on a subway that got overcrowded and is in need of massive upgrades that the state and city together seem incapable of actually carrying off on any reasonable time frame, much less for a reasonable cost.
Yeah. And let's not forget also the traffic from all of these bike lanes that have been put in, these bus lanes that half the time are never used, and these nice promenades right dab in the middle of Times Square that choke off traffic lanes. And
that's been very controversial, all of that too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but Uber, you know, is definitely a problem. I mean, in San Francisco, when you stand there, the birthplace of Uber, it's like you don't see any private cars anymore. They're all rideshare cars. So,
right.
Yeah. And that's a viable alternative for many people who wouldn't otherwise take taxis because they're inconvenient, unobtainable.
Right.
And the horrid conditions of your average taxi. So we've got Comrade de Blasio here. That's an endearment. He's definitely a collectivist at heart. And his plan for New York City appears to be chaos. He loves homeless people, loves homeless shelters, especially when he can put them in the Upper East Side and on Billionaire's Row. Is there anything that can stop this person? He's like a force of nature.
Well, he's term limited, so the answer is yes. I mean, it's not just, I mean, there's a lot of criticism of him in particular. Mm-hmm. He'll be gone in a couple more years. The one unspoken aspect of this issue with the vagrancy and homelessness is that a lot of these people are severely mentally ill.
Yes.
And the failure of this is true around the country, but the failure to varying degrees, but the failure to deal with that issue. This is not a Homelessness, when you say homeless, you imply an economic problem.
Yes.
Oh, you know, they're homeless. They can't afford to get an apartment. No. I mean, you go to where they, you see this problem, and you see that it's overwhelmingly comprised of people who are
drug addicts,
severe
alcoholics,
substance abusers, yeah, or severely mentally ill, and or both. There's a lot of severely mentally ill people, yes, in that population. And what you're looking at is a massive failure. And what's really striking is to deal with and treat that population and figure out a better way. And in fact, you don't hear either the governor or the mayor or most politicians ever say a word about it. They talk about homelessness.
Mm-hmm.
They don't talk about the severely mentally ill. And that is a problem to varying degrees all over the country, as you know.
Yeah, well, I started trying to start a movement for reinstitutionalization because you're a New Yorker. I'm a New Yorker. I think we're experts in homelessness, probably more than any sociologist. And like you said, it's not a failure of economic policy. It is a mental health crisis. And until we treat it that way, and in the good old days, and I'm not saying they were good and I'm not relishing them by any stretch, but at one point in the U.S., when the population was less than half of what it is today, we had 500 plus thousand people involuntarily committed. Now, the total is somewhere from 45 to 100,000. The population has doubled. The drug epidemic has taken over. So until we address the real issue here, it's not because they can't afford a place, because if you're a working person and your budget's limited and your neighborhood gets too expensive, you move to a cheaper neighborhood. That's the way it works. So,
right,
you know, the politicians really are deceitful on this issue, and you could basically turn Rikers Island, empty the jail and turn it into a big homeless shelter. And I don't think it would make a dent on things.
I think you're largely correct. Your point. That's another very big problem that goes beyond all the economic and tax issues. And unfortunately, it's just not being dealt with urgently. Really unfortunate.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not saying Giuliani dealt with it properly. I interviewed Commissioner Carrick and I asked him directly, and he said, well, when people needed help, we got them help. There is no help for these people because there are no institutions, because you and I both know, EJ, that there are people who cannot be left to their own devices on the streets. They must be in a locked, supervised environment, medicated. And that's the other thing. You can't forcibly medicate these people, even though you know when they stop taking their medication that they are going to go crazy and be a potential danger to society. We're kind of hamstrung by all of these liberal policies that got us here in the first place.
Well, I agree with you. And I would say these policies actually were unfortunately promoted and or tolerated or their impacts ignored by politicians in both parties.
Mm-hmm.
I never saw, you know, a significant push for change for out of Republicans either, frankly.
No.
And I think that we're returning right back to the days. It sounds like you remember them. Remember when Ed Koch was expressing alarm. Remember the woman who called herself Billy Boggs after a local talk show host who was crazy and
right,
you know, basically basically defacing by her personal behavior an entire neighborhood in the Upper West Side.
Terrorized the whole neighborhood. Yeah.
And she was, you know, she had,
it was insane.
Kindly, had issues. And this was became a whole, you know, civil rights extravaganza. And remember that Koch, with that commonsensical way he had way back then, 30-odd years ago,
mm-hmm,
his attitude, you know, he was saying, this is crazy. I won't do my imitation of, but you know, he like spoke for the commonsensical person. But, you know, she, and remember her mantra was, I'm not insane, just homeless.
Yeah.
Well, you know, but that is still the problem.
Yeah. It really is.
And, so, yeah. I mean, that still is basically, you know, exemplifies the problem. There were some programs, in fact, one into which she ultimately, you know, but that ultimately helped her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's the problem is turned the pendulum has now swung pretty far, and the problem is still with us. It seems worse than ever.
Yeah, and a few other things with the problem is that a lot of these people wind up in jail, these insane or mentally ill people, because there is no other place to put them, and that is the worst place where they could be, although they can forcibly medicate them in jail, and I think they do. The other thing is the cost in San Francisco where in Seattle, where I've seen numbers, and this doesn't include the cost of incarcerating homeless people who probably should not be in jail, but the cost is $40,000 a year. We could set up institutions here to house them and hopefully treat the ones who are treatable, because a certain portion of them, if they got off the street and on meds, would be productive and sane and self-sufficient. So the cost of this $40,000 a year to keep them on the street, there's no constitutional right to be homeless, right? I mean, I don't see it there.
In New York, there is.
Yeah, I guess so.
It's a whole big area, and it's off. One could devote like an entire career to, much less a conversation, but it is a big problem. And it is remarkable that this is the most visible problem that I think upsets and concerns probably the vast majority, more New Yorkers than anything else most recently, and not just New Yorkers. And it's the degree to which it's ignored by the politicians is really surprising.
It's criminal.
Or incredible, really, in light of how important it is.
Bordering on criminal, EJ, really.
Well,
because
it's bad.
It's human rights here. It's a no greater human rights issue. And the Republicans, to their own stupidity, the party of stupid, if they ran on a program of eliminating mentally ill people from the street and putting them in appropriate places, could make huge inroads, because there's no greater impact on one's neighborhood. You wake up in the morning and you open your door and there's a homeless person sleeping on a mentally ill homeless person sleeping on your doorstep, and you go to the subway.
There are hundreds and thousands of Billy Boggses all over the city, and
A huge opportunity.
The difference between us and California is that the weather in California is pleasant enough so that there are these enormous camps, so-called. Mm-hmm. There's less vacant land and it's colder in New York, so it's more in front of buildings, et cetera. But if you take a train to Penn Station and wander around the Penn Station neighborhood, you will get an eyeful and an earful. It's tough. Yeah. It's tough. It's inhuman and it's tough, and something should be done about it.
And you want to help them, but you are totally powerless. You're totally powerless to do anything for them, EJ. You can't help them.
Right. There are severe human indignities on display that just assault you and your conscience your humanity, in effect, but you can't do anything about it.
You feel like the Kitty Genovese murder. Somebody call the police. Somebody do something, because there's nothing you can do yourself to, you're just a bystander and you're affected by it. So, and if there's anything that could improve the quality of life in New York City and state, because it's statewide, the issue, it's that for sure.
Yeah.
And, enough of people, other states giving people bus tickets to New York and let New York handle it. I mean, this problem's been ongoing. I remember it from the 60s and the bathrooms in the Port Authority. Horrible. Anyway, EJ, I could go on talking with you about New York all day long.
Okay.
Hey, just tell us Manhattan Institute and the Empire, what you guys do there and why it's so important.
Well, you can see our work at empirecenter.org. We are a think tank, nonpartisan, nonprofit think tank focused on public policy in New York State and the whole state, not just, we're based in Albany, actually. Mm-hmm. And we focus on policy ideas and solutions that will make New York a better place to live, work, and raise a family, and focus on promoting free market-oriented solutions and the goals and principles of personal responsibility and political accountability.
Well, you're a little too modest there in describing the works of both both entities, because you're the voice of reason, maybe the last remaining voice of reason that has a platform in the state. And for people who are thinking and who are critically minded, perhaps the only advocate for sanity, fiscal and otherwise, in the state. So we really applaud your efforts for that. Grateful to you. Hey, any questions, comments for EJ, myself, just send me an email, kl@kerrylutz.com. Our Twitter feed's at Kerry Lutz, Facebook page, Financial Survival Network. EJ, really appreciate you coming on. It's been a total pleasure. We will talk to you again real soon.
Thank you, Kerry. Thank you. Have a good day.
FSN Radio. It's all about what's next. Go to financialsurvivalnetwork.com and sign up for your free weekly newsletter. You'll also get three free reports. The Financial Survival Network. It's all about what's next.